Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Raya Affairs. My name is Nicola, and I'll be your host for this episode. Raya is a youth-led international think tank that translates the abstract world of international affairs by simplifying rather than generalizing. Raya is a place where you come to learn about the stories and worries of political leaders, the behind-the-scenes of decision-makers, and how politics impacts and changes your life. This is Raya Affairs, filling you in wherever you are. As always, we start with a disclaimer that expressed opinion in these episodes are welcome, even though they are not a direct reflection of Raya, as we specialize in unbiased writing. So this is the third episode in a series of six as part of the IE Raya Summer Research Program of 2025. Raya has invited 12 IE University students to join our think tank and spend 9 weeks researching a figure from around the world to try to answer a simple question. Are they a climate leader? During their research, students have done a deep dive of the person's background, policies, and the impact of said policies in an effort to bring light to the diverse ways in which every person, no matter the role they play in society, can contribute to the global climate change policy framework. In today's episode, we will be focusing on David Attenborough, British natural historian and documentary filmmaker. Here with us, we have Giulio Guiducci and Javier Guatam. Welcome to Raya Affairs, guys. It's a pleasure to have you here, and thank you very much for joining me today. Would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Yes. Thank you, Nicola, for the introduction. I am Giulio. I'm going into my third year of my degree as law and international relations at IE University, and I am excited to be here to discuss David Attenborough and his role as a climate leader.
Okay, I'll start with my introduction. Hi, I'm Javier. I'm going to my second year of international relations, and I'm from Mumbai, India, and I've spent most of my life there. And I'm really excited to talk about David Attenborough as well.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction, guys. And before we start, I'll ask you to answer our usual icebreaking question. This is a question that we ask every guest here on the podcast. So could you tell us which leader, either dead or alive, who has impacted the world, would you want to have a conversation with and why?
This may sound a bit easy for me to say, but honestly, I'm going to say David Attenborough. Why? Since I was a child, I mean, I've been always studying at a British school. So, you know, every time we watched a kind of nature documentary, like learning about animals in primary school when you're five, it was always David Attenborough on the screen. His very, very soothing voice, ways of describing imagery, describing the animals, and teaching the youth makes a really, really big impact and is definitely a great learning tool and a great delivery information tool that you can just fall in love with. So just talking to him would be great, and especially because we're also writing this report about him, just learning more on his insights, because now we can only find secondary sources. I mean, obviously we can look at his interviews and stuff, but honestly, just having that conversation one-on-one with him would like really, really make me understand his point of view and that passion that is crazy for the environment and that I really, really admire.
Well, for me, I would go along the same lines, but because I think both of us just love the UK for some reason, because I would talk to Princess Diana. I know how crazy that sounds, but I don't know, like, to be in her position is something that is so far removed from where I am right now. And just to like talk to her, like, you know, check up on her. I know a lot of people will say this, but it's always really intrigued me and fascinated me. So I would say that.
Well, that's great, guys. Really nice picks. We stay in the British world. Giulio, easy answer. You chose the leader we are talking about today. Javier, it's actually quite common. I heard Lady Diana. I heard a lot of guests coming up with Lady Diana as the person they would have liked to have a conversation with. But still, I mean, definitely two interesting characters. I would enjoy a good dinner with both of them. So thank you very much, guys. And now I would say that we can start our conversation about your report on David Attenborough. And I would like to start with David Attenborough himself. He has been called one of the world's most trusted voices on nature and climate. In your report, you explain how his career basically evolved from simply documenting wildlife to actively campaigning for environmental protection. So could you please summarize his personal and professional journey for us? And in your opinion, what makes his approach to climate leadership so unique? especially considering that he has never held political office but still managed to influence global climate discourse?
Yeah, so, I mean, David Attenborough, he is widely regarded, as you said, widely regarded as one of the most influential environmental communicators. He is a natural historian, he's a documentary filmmaker, and he has dedicated over 70 years to educating the public and the natural world. I mean, he's almost, he's 99 years old and still going strong. So yeah, he has dedicated most of his life to the study of nature, anthropology, natural history, and just documenting and educating people about this. However, like his stance on climate change, we're gonna delve deeper into that probably later on, but it's not always been the same. I mean, in the 1950s, when he started his career as a BBC presenter with documentaries like Zoo Quest, the focus of these documentaries was only to showcase wildlife and remote cultures, you know, like just identifying different funky species, kind of. But like, you know, throughout the career, his documentaries advanced and he ended up producing many, many iconic series like that now like hit 1 billion viewers on Netflix, like Life on Earth, Planet Earth, and then there's the Blue Planet series, Blue Planet 2, which have had a massive worldwide impact. However, yeah, as I said, his climate advocacy has not always been there necessarily. There has been a turning point that we'll analyze in 2004. And from 2004 onwards, he has produced and produced documentaries more on the direct effects of climate change, the negative impact, and has raised alarms and raised urgency and like kind of created a call for action on mitigating climate change, of course. Aside from this, he has been named the most trusted public figure in the UK in 2018, which gives him the sense of credibility. So when he's fighting for, when he's urging people to change their behavior, to act, to mitigate climate change, well, I think this credibility really does put him in a unique position to shape public opinion. He is not a political leader, so I mean, obviously he can't directly implement policy, but I feel like this credibility that the people give him kind of helps him, puts him in a unique position to shape behavior. And shaping behavior is essentially what shapes voting patterns, and then that can change policy. So this is a very unique and particular position to have, and he really navigates this well in order to call to action. So his unique impact lies basically in combining his scientific credibility, emotional storytelling, and mass research without holding office.
Well, yes, I agree with Giulio that what makes him particularly interesting as a climate leader is that he's not actually a political leader, but his ability to influence policy and to influence behavioral change in the population, this is what makes him so important to us today. And one of Attenborough's strongest messages is that we are consuming Earth's resources far beyond sustainable limits. How does he frame overconsumption in his documentaries and public speeches? I read in your report that he puts a lot of emphasis on overpopulation and capitalism as the main drivers of overconsumption. Could you please explain to our audience what his message is regarding this topic?
Yeah, so when we were analyzing all of his documentaries and we were going through his discography, right, we realized that overconsumption, overpopulation, and broadly anti-capitalist themes were very prevalent in his work. In this context, at least to David Attenborough, we extracted that overconsumption is defined as the use of resources at a level that exceeds the sustainable thresholds, right? He tries to focus on these domestic aspects of overconsumption and often points to the fact that nearly 60% of global greenhouse gas emissions are from the use of resources at a local level by households, right? He frames this idea that using these resources directly impacts not only not only our standard of living, but also the standard of living around the world, right? Coming from developed or developing countries, there's a clear difference there, which he all constantly highlights. He frames this issue also of planetary boundaries, looking at the works of Kate Raworth, who highlights these 9 boundaries, right? 6 of which are exceeded, right? Using these boundaries as a framework, he says that overpopulation is a primary driver for overconsumption, saying that the world's population as being almost 8 billion right now and almost 9.7 billion by 2050 is something that's really detrimental to our planet's capacity to not only sustain ourselves, but sustain itself, right? But what could be driving all of this overconsumption, this need to constantly consume, right? He says that the reason for this is capitalism. The need for capital and having access to capital and all these cheap goods quickly is fundamentally a driver for competition. Competition that leads people to produce more and then consume more, right? And that's basically how he works around overconsumption. Then he also talks about the idea of a circular economy as not only a solution, but also something that needs to be in the conversation for overconsumption, maintaining that if we do want to find a way for these developing countries, which in his view are also developed in certain ways and also developing in the aspect that all countries need to develop towards growth sustainably, right? So no one in the world right now is developed in his eyes, right? He says that we need to focus on ideas of reducing our consumption while maintaining standards of living, and ecocentric models of circular economies being very important for the same.
So you also write that Attenborough has spent a lifetime documenting both the beauty and the decline of nature. A key concern in his work is environmental degradation, which basically refers to the deterioration of natural ecosystems caused by human activity. So I wanted to ask you, what is the relationship between environmental degradation and climate change? What are the main sources of this degradation? And why is Attenborough's work, which aims to raise awareness in the public regarding this topic, so important?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's obviously like, because Attenborough has been documenting nature for 70 years and he has seen nature for 99 years. He has seen how he has documented, literally documented, the decline of the natural world. Throughout his lifetime, he has basically seen how forests have decreased in size, how the ocean has become more saturated with carbon dioxide and therefore cannot absorb any more, the destruction of mangrove rainforests, and many more landscapes that he has documented. These experiences have revealed to him how fragile and interconnected life on Earth is, and how environmental damage threatens not only wildlife, but also human well-being. What he says is that there's like a negative feedback loop, because climate change reduces the capability of forests and the oceans to absorb carbon dioxide. So this reduction creates more carbon dioxide in the environment, which then more like reduces even more the capacity of these natural environments to absorb. So there's just a negative feedback loop that relates environmental degradation with climate change. With less nature, more climate change, and with more climate change, less nature. And it keeps going. So how he tries to tackle this is by saying we have to protect nature and let it recover. Because if we let recover nature, climate change will in itself, by itself, reduce. Because if there's a negative feedback loop one way, there's a positive feedback loop the other way. Then he moves on into like describing what the leading causes of environmental degradation are and why there's such a big negative loop. So yeah, the leading causes of environmental degradation are deforestation and inefficient farm use. Why? Well, deforestation, again, like the massive cutting down of forests and trees, and these green areas reduce the Earth's capability to absorb carbon dioxide. We've been through this. And then inefficient farmland use is also a main driver of biodiversity loss. The fact that we're destroying habitats to put our cattle in reduces habitats, which in turn like decreases the nutrients in the soil, creates acidic soil, plants can't grow. So it's everything is just a negative feedback loop. So restoring nature is definitely something positive, because if we restore nature, climate change is going to go down. So yeah, preventing further damage to the environment is therefore essential. But his main behavioral change that he advocates is embracing vegetarianism. He's a vegetarian himself because obviously farmland use comes from cattle, from sheep, animals that we eat essentially. So by embracing vegetarianism, there will not be a need for such wide farms and farmland, so that land can be then restored for nature, and this can then decrease climate change and the amount and levels of CO2 in the atmosphere.
Well, Attenborough has also been a vocal critic of fossil fuels and a strong supporter of renewable energy. Why is his advocacy in favor of renewable energy so important? And I mean, does he see the transition to renewable energies as a necessary thing that we actually need to implement as soon as possible? Or he tends to realize that there are also challenges associated with this transition?
Yes, so David Attenborough, like through his interviews in particular and his work, like sort of outside of his documentaries as well, does focus on his critique of fossil fuels. Now, this stems from him being from one of the most developed countries in the world, which is the UK, with nearly 38.68% of all energy coming from oil and another 32.89% coming from gas. And therefore, with nearly 74%, around 74% of all energy coming from fossil fuels, it puts it in a very precarious situation that David Attenborough, of course, as a naturalist, is very aware of, right? Fossil fuels to him are also the main driving source for climate change. Therefore, he believes that a switch to renewable energy is something that humanity has to do, otherwise, there's no other option, right? Now, when it comes to whether or not he believes that there are challenges, of course there are challenges, right? There are challenges not only culturally but also economically, and whether these such drastic changes feasible is something that Attenborough himself always voices a concern over. However, he remains hopeful. His messages are mostly hopeful because he doesn't want to discourage anyone from sort of looking at the avenue that we can have a shift towards renewable energy, right? In particular, he highlights the importance of solar energy as his primary like choice of renewable energy, you could say, to like sort of replace fossil fuels, right? Just a few more facts about fossil fuels. It got like it. The infrastructure for the same costs nearly 1.7 to $3.1 trillion dollars a year, and pollutants cause over 4.2 million premature deaths. Not to mention how this disturbs biological cycles and the physical deterioration of the environment, right? Therefore, on all aspects, fossil fuels to him are a major area of concern.
In your report, you identified the 2004 lecture by atmospheric chemist and professor Ralph Cicerone at the University of Liège as the turning point that transformed Attenborough from a neutral observer into a climate activist. This is exactly the transition we were talking about before. And Attenborough himself explained in a later interview that he had initially been skeptical about human actions having an effect on climate change. But Cicerone's presentation convinced him that humanity was actually responsible for climate change. So, why was this moment so significant for him personally and professionally? And how did it change the way he approached climate change in his documentaries? And what does it tell us about the role of climate education and research in driving climate action?
Yeah, so in his lecture, I mean, the lecture that convinced David Attenborough that climate change was actually human-made and anthropologic. Professor Cicerone presents graphs that shows the clear coincidence between the increase of CO2, carbon dioxide, the rise in temperature, and the growth of human population and industrialization. And these essentially convince the Attenborough that humanity was responsible for climate change. Essentially, to make it short, Cicerone outlined the greenhouse effect and what it implies for temperature control and fluctuations. Then he presented a series of graphs and diagrams, first of their kind for Attenborough at least, that served as clear evidence that climate change was real and caused by human activity. He emphasizes the link between the rising amounts of greenhouse gases and in the atmosphere and human activity, and this is what essentially convinced David Attenborough that human activity is the main contributor to climate change, and he was motivated mainly by the professor's suggestion that reducing consumption and introducing solar power were the main steps to mitigating climate change. In fact, we just discussed that his main stakes, his main drivers for change were overconsumption and over-reliance on fossil fuels. So like, this is the lecture that convinced him that consumption and fossil fuels were bad and were like, and that humans were causing the climate change. And to combat that, we need renewable energy and to reduce consumption. Just after the lecture, Attenborough became increasingly engaged in discussions himself. Like, Attenborough himself became increasingly engaged in discussions with the BBC to produce programs dedicated to climate change. And since then, the tone and messages of his documentaries have shifted and always include advocacy, urgency towards the problems that the environment faces due to human-caused climate change. So, as we mentioned before, like in his documentaries in the 1950s, the 1970s, he was more just showcasing wildlife, how pristine it was, how beautiful it was, like the how different species interact with each other. After 2004, he's taken a big turn, 180-degree turn, and is now urging people, is like showcasing the devastating effects of climate change. He's no longer showing the pristine environments, he's now showing the destruction that climate change is causing, that human activity is causing, and therefore urging us to change our behavior. In fact, we did some analysis, and before 2004, he put out around 80 documentaries, and only one of them had the only had the sole focus of climate change, which was in 2000. And after 2004, he has already put out 11 documentaries with the sole purpose of advocating to mitigate climate change. So you can see a clear change of tone, change of pace, change of urgency towards mitigating climate change. And I guess this can be called his defining moment as a climate leader, you know? And it highlights the critical role that climate education and research play in driving climate action. It demonstrates how clear scientific evidence, provided by Professor Cicciarone in this case, can turn skepticism into advocacy, emphasizing the power of data and informed communication. So with education, you understand the problems and therefore can take a better approach and a knowledge, more knowledged approach on how to solve them. And I guess from there, Attenborough has also taken a stance and through his documentaries, not only educates the people, but also proposes solutions and proposes behavioral change that can help us mitigate climate change.
Yeah, and Attenborough's documentaries are often described as his most impactful initiatives in the battle against climate change. So my next question is, why is it so? I mean, what is so special about them? In the report, you write that he wants to educate the public about climate change issues, raise awareness of its challenges, and ultimately mobilize public opinion, which would in turn shape policy. Did he actually manage to do that?
We all know David Attenborough for his documentaries, right? I mean, that's what he's most famous for. And that's, I think, one of his many, many talents, right? His ability to capture an audience, the ability to educate an audience, and to really influence our lives through these documentaries, right? Now, what we realized is that we didn't really quite understand how big these documentaries actually were. In fact, one of their main driving points is the fact that they have such a big global reach, right? Since they're not really bound by any boundaries, right? Like normal policies would. This is like a truly global initiative that he has. For example, his documentary Our Planet was streamed by nearly 45 million Netflix accounts, which accounts for nearly 90 to 180 million views in just the first month. Right? Again, having access to such platforms means that he doesn't really discriminate this access based by nationality or anything, just access to these, like, you know, streaming devices, right? Blue Planet 2, which was released before Netflix actually became really popular in like around 2017, reached nearly 1 billion people, and that was just through the BBC, right? So he's always had this sort of international global reach that his documentaries has, which makes them so special, right? Now, the core message or the core ideology behind all of these documentaries is the Attenborough effect, which me and Julio both analyze heavily. For example, after Blue Planet 2, as I discussed before, nearly 88% of UK viewers changed their habits, right? Nearly 60% increased their use of reusable water bottles, and nearly 70% of this audience was really young, between 18 to 24 year olds, right? The Google searches for plastic recycling increased by nearly 50%, right? And the dangers of plastic in our oceans, that search, nearly doubled, right? We can clearly see that his words, his ideas, his messages, his imagery in these documentaries has a very studied impact on consumer behavior, basically, right? And that is what makes it so important. The ability to reach individuals and change individual change, right, is just as important as changing things on a macro level. And that is what makes him, honestly, a leader for the people, right? Therefore, he's all, of course, ranked as one of the UK's most trusted figures by YouGov poll in 2018, but also the most popular figure from the UK, according to that same poll, right? Therefore, the documentaries are really important for his advocacy. In fact, they're both the starting point and the main driver, right? So there's also an environmental impact and motivation to these things. For example, his documentaries, if we had to generalize them, they use Schwartz norm activation theory, which basically uses moral emotions to drive pro-environmental behavior, right? While preventing things like greenwashing or instilling fear into audiences in order to drive change, right? Using both a mixture of positive and negative emotions to balance that out creates a nuanced approach to environmental advocacy. Also, he motivates this through the pairing of both facts and imagery, right? For example, most of his documentaries, the first half presents these sort of negative imagery and facts, whereas the second half often offers solutions and positive imagery, right? With scientific credibility also being really important, he's worked with the UNEP, the WWF, Flora and Fauna, also the BBC's Natural History Unit, right? So his scientific rigor is also very important for these documentaries, right? However, there are limitations, right? Especially when it comes to the measured impact of behavioral change, as that's mostly an abstract concept, I would say, and it's really hard to measure at times, right? For example, there might be some evidences of audience fatigue and selective reception, especially based on precognitive biases, right? For example, political views influence the receptiveness of these ideas. For example, progressive audiences are more receptive to his ideas than more conservative audiences, which of course impacts how his documentaries are perceived and viewed, right? And his impact can be seen as short-term, right, or short-lived. For example, it's very easy to forget the true essence of his documentaries, even if you remember the imagery and the message, right? And an analysis of over 2 million tweets showed that there's a lot of fluctuation in these responses based also on how other people respond to these things, right? However, there has been a measured policy impact for his documentaries. As Julio mentioned before, there's a impact where his documentaries affect a consumer behavior, and consumer behavior, of course, affects voter behavior, and voter behavior affects policy changes. Right. For example, he influenced a ban on single-use plastics, for example, on straws and plastic bags in the UK. Theresa May, the Prime Minister, also cited his influence as being very important for the 25-year environmental plan. And his documentaries, of course, as mentioned before, has led to an 83% drop in the use of plastic bags. And also, he helped frame the national goal for environment, and especially to eliminate plastic waste by 2041. Right. So as a whole, his documentaries are really, really, really important for his climate advocacy, even though there might be a few limitations in the same. I would say, like, personally, these limitations are, of course, outshined by the positive effects that he does have.
And another initiative that you analyze in the report is the Save Our Wild Isles campaign in collaboration with the WWF. Could you please explain to our audience what this campaign is, what are its main goals, and what has been its impact?
Yes, so David Attenborough became increasingly worried with the state of the UK nature. I mean, currently the UK, like the only 3% of the landmass of the UK is protected for nature. So it makes it one of the least naturally intact countries in the world, actually, with a lot of his landmass just not protected for nature. So, I mean, this is concerned because one out of six species in the UK was endangered or in high risk of becoming endangered. There's been a massive biodiversity loss, massive deforestation. So, like, this puts the UK at risk of, like, being of desertification and essentially just being naturally depleted. And as we mentioned before, environmental degradation increases climate change. So if the UK becomes nature depleted, climate change is going to increase by a lot because its natural land will not be able to absorb the CO2 that they produce. So David Attenborough produced a documentary called the Save Our Wild Isles, Silver Wild Isles. And with this, in collaboration with the WWF, launched a campaign in 2023. Here, I mean, he voices obviously the concern that the UK is very nature depleted, and then obviously it proposes solutions to battle this problem. The aim was clear. It was two clear aims: restore wooded landscapes and transition to nature-friendly farming. This also goes hand in hand with the deforestation and inefficient farmland use that we discussed before. So basically, he wants to diversify farm animals to create a mix of habitats. So we discussed that the problem with inefficient farmland use is that it lacks habitat, it lacks biodiversity. So by diversifying farm animals, it creates a mix of habitats, increases biodiversity. What do I mean by this? Well, for example, allowing barn owls to come into the barn, like give them a little habitat, you know, allowing the introduction of different plants and shrubbery along the borders of the farm, maybe. All of this just helps increase the biodiversity in the area, and it makes farming efficient, which is what is needed to battle this inefficient land use. And finally, like the second aim is the addition the farming reform, not the farming reform we just talked about, this the restoring the wooded landscapes. He proposes to plant specific trees that withstand harsh environments in mountainous areas upstream, because with a big upstream, like with a strong upstream environment, that brings nutrients down to the downstream environment. So by restoring the upstream, there will be downstream benefits. So he proposes plans to start planting trees in the upstream environments, like very specific trees to withstand these harsh environments. And he also, because he mentions that the creation of new and renewed wildlife upstream will then benefit wildlife communities living downstream. Importantly, though, the campaign encapsulated 26 actions that are needed to reverse the wider impact of the environment and outlines clear policy implementations that stemmed from the suggestions that Attenborough made in his documentary. So that's what the website says, you know, it just gives you the 26 actions. And from these 26 actions, there has been like direct people advocacy. There's this thing in the UK called the People's Plan for Nature, in which they list a set of things that they want the UK government to do for nature. So this public change of behavior, kind of this public action, directly stemmed from this campaign, which is again, like if we mentioned before, David Attenborough's position in mobilizing public, in mobilizing mass support. This is what he does. He gains a lot of media attention. I mean, the campaign itself had 1.58 billion impressions, with 400,000 people taking part in campaign actions. So it's a massive public mobilization. That's what we what we talked about. It also raised around £2 million for on-the-ground conservation projects. So meaning that this campaign had direct effects in mitigating climate change. After the campaign, I think the Royal Society for the Birds in the UK bought 1 million, what a 1 million area of forest to be able to protect it and restore it for nature. So we can see already in the short term, we can already see positive impact. What else? Oh yeah, the campaign also had very political impact, which is it's really important because yes, we talk about David Attenborough having like the power to mobilize support, but this campaign also managed to mobilize political power. Basically, the campaign became a concern to the policymakers across parties, not only necessarily on one side of the party, but across parties. They included nature's presence in their election manifesto. So in their manifestos for election, they included the environment relating to this campaign. And even like in July 2023, there's this anecdote, like a high profile event called the Save Our Wild Isles reception was held in Westminster Abbey Gardens. And it brought together many MPs, business leaders, and community organizations. And yeah, like attendees, as I said, like included the likes of like Jeff Smith from Labour, who he publicly affirmed that the plan's legitimacy, like he affirmed that the plan had legitimacy, the people's plan that stemmed directly from this campaign. And he was committed to championing the recommendations in Parliament. And through this parliamentary event, over hundreds of other MPs across parties publicly pledged support to the stronger environmental protections, signaling cross-party engagement. So not only Attenborough is mobilizing the mass, the people, he is also mobilizing MPs and people in position of power that are actually likely to then implement the policy. And it is not only reduced to this, like also in the run-up to the July 2024 election, so a year later, key parties, including Labour, Liberal Democrats and the Green Party, explicitly incorporated commitments focused on nature and biodiversity in their manifestos. The Labour Party even pledged a countryside protection plan with 9 new national river walks, 3 national rainforests and bans on harmful pesticides on the... on the other hand, like the Liberal Democrats committed to doubling nature by 2050. Protecting at least 30% of land and sea, planting 6 million trees annually, and introducing a new Environmental Rights Act. We can't still say that these have been implemented. However, they have been pledged. So we can in that case be hopeful that David Attenborough has the capability to influence public opinion. So public policy making. So yes, it's crazy how he manages to navigate his mass support into policy action.
Yes, definitely. I completely agree with you. This is probably the most impressive thing about this initiative. And this initiative really seems like a really impressive and impactful one.
Yeah, so I wanted to mention, because I think it's really important to mention how good of a public reaction this campaign had and how much mass this mobilized, because that is the effect that we need to essentially then affect policy making. The campaign also pioneered a two-phase action plan to mitigate the effects of climate change. It's what we were talking about before, about the education part, like giving the viewers, the public a little push, you know, educating them on what to do, on what direction to take. So obviously, the action plan kind of like they created an assembly and they told the people how to input the solutions. You know, they recommended how to act, what decisions to take, and finally, like they agreed on some solutions and they agreed on how to perform these solutions. No, it was kind of a step-by-step guidebook on how to change your behavior and how to mitigate climate change. And by the end of this assembly, like it was open, there was a 34% increase in participants that felt like they knew a lot about UK nature, while those that knew very little decreased to 3%. So obviously, like It's important because many people didn't know that their own country, the UK, lacked that nature. So now, after this assembly, it increased by 34%. And yeah, and what I was saying, there's also stats about awareness of UK nature loss. This also increased, with 67% of the participants agreeing that the country had lost too much of its natural land. And finally, 34% more people said that they believe they could personally make a difference. And many more felt like they had the responsibility to protect nature. It is these percentages that then translate into policy making. And finally, to end it, the process was also very positively received. As I mentioned before, the stats exactly are 90% of the participants rated their experience 4 out of 5 stars, and 98% said they enjoyed it.
Wow, this is definitely impressive. And now I would like to talk about the last initiative I would like to talk with you about is the People Seed Campaign. So in the months leading up to the COP24 conference, the UN, in collaboration with David Attenborough, launched the People Seed Campaign, basically encouraging social media users to share their experiences and their opinions on climate change. So what can you tell us about this initiative?
Now, in my eyes, this initiative is actually one of his most his bravest, right? Because this is not only a mix of who he is, but also who he wants to be as an advocacy leader, right? Because this basically, it incorporates both his role as a media influencer, you could say, and his role as a documentarian, but also his role as someone who acts almost as a conduit between the people and policymakers, right? The People's Seat started off as a public engagement campaign by the UN and David Attenborough, as mentioned previously. It started off with a short video, which was like around a minute, where David Attenborough basically encourages internet users to sort of use the hashtag Take Your Seat, but also use this hashtag with sort of concerns for the environment that they have, right? This, of course, went really viral, and it led to nearly 1.3 billion people engaging and using the hashtag and like engaging in the content as a whole, right? So you can imagine this led to the accumulation of a lot of perspectives, a lot of opinions about not only climate change, but also wider environmental degradation issues, right? This basically helped raise awareness for not only the systematic impacts of climate change, but also how individuals themselves perceive climate change, right? And why this is important for leaders as a whole, right? Eventually, the UN, in collaboration with the Attenborough, of course, they compiled all of this evidence, and Attenborough delivered a speech at the COP24 conference to all the attendees, right? This includes leaders from all over the world that want to sort of help guide and navigate issues of climate change, right? And also, when the video of his speech was issued to the public, it reached nearly 16 million views in the first 24 hours, clearly showcasing that people care about his opinion about climate change, but also how their opinion is represented to climate leaders as a whole, right? What makes this campaign also more interesting is because it included an Act Now bot, right? This Act Now bot was sort of like an intelligence that was used to sort of guide users, especially on Facebook, on how their advocacy, sorry, on how their behavioral changes and their actions was either negative or positive for the environment, right? So the bot would basically work in conjunction with the user to sort of help change their behavior as well, right? And this is almost one of the first uses of technology in this way, right? And it was also mentioned in a speech, right, that this bot exists, right? And was a part of the Act Now campaign as a well, as a whole as well. Now, many supporters of this campaign say that it helped catalyze the COP24 agreement, which was historically signed by 200 countries to cap emissions, right? And with many European countries and some developing countries as well strengthening their NDCs, as a part of this campaign, and a part as like you know as a consequence of this campaign as well, but many view this people's seat as more of a symbolic gesture rather than an active policy change, right? Or an active, like, influence on policy, right? But even with it being symbolic, it's really important to recognize Anhe's role, not only because of the UN's belief in his position to represent the people, but also his ability to deliver such a speech to such a wide audience. That is really important to sort of highlight his importance as an environmental leader, right? However, there are some criticisms and limitations to the people's seat. Despite its very positive reception, there are of course concerns with individuals who don't have access to the internet, right, which are often the most marginalized by climate change issues, right? It's often those that can't engage with David Attenborough's work that are most in need for his advocacy to be effective, right? That's a dilemma that we see throughout all of his policies as well, right? With many global South and indigenous communities being underrepresented. Also, his participation requires a lot of resources and activism that many youths lack as well, right? Which is also another issue, because as much as David Attenborough emphasizes importance and emphasizes the need for action, there is a clear gap between whether people can take action in the first place, right? And also some activists see the initiative almost as a distraction, you could say, because while it does sort of legitimize the importance of climate change, the its lack of ability to actually drive policy change is really critical there. But it has, of course, gained a lot of communication success and recognition because its role as sort of a media campaign was really successful, right? For example, it won the Gold Cannes Lions Award for Public Relations and Innovation, while also like boosting climate awareness, engagement, and improving the UN's global image, right? Therefore, even though its direct policy impact might be debated, it's very, very important to highlight that its presence as the first of its kind, as a groundbreaking initiative, is really important, right? And also shows that we the people are also getting more of a stake in these discussions, getting more of a voice in these discussions, even if it's through a conduit such as David Attenborough. I mean, if you ask me, what but a conduit is there for such a thing, right? Anyways, the main idea here is that the concept and the symbol of this people's plan, or sorry, this people's seat, is really important for future advocacy as well.
Yes, and I think this last two initiatives we talked about, they show exactly what we were saying before. So even as a documentary filmmaker, his documentaries had a huge impact on the public, but at the same time, he was able to go beyond this and came up with initiatives such as the Save Our Wild Isle campaign and the People's Seat, which are definitely groundbreaking, as Jaivir noted. And we almost made it to the end of the episode, guys. I just have one last question to ask you. And this is a question that we asked also all the different teams that we had here for the summer research program. So at the end of this researching period, you basically spent 9 weeks researching David Attenborough. And the question is, after all that, after all these months going into his initiatives, his personality, his history, etc., do you believe he is actually a climate leader? And especially considering that he's never been in a formal position of power. And perhaps more importantly, what can current and future climate activists learn from his way of communicating and mobilizing people?
I mean, despite never holding office, Attenborough has shaped public opinion, informed policy, and inspired global action. We can say that for sure. I mean, we've been analyzing him. We talked about the public opinion for the documentary, so the Save Our Wild Isles campaign, and to the People's Seat. It has even managed to inform policy debates, you know, with the MPs stating that they will mention environment in their campaigns and everything. And global action, especially in the People's Seat with the UN, has inspired people from around the globe to use the Act Now bot and, like, tune in to the COP events. So he has done everything that a policymaker can do except make policy. However, we can even link that he has even managed to navigate through his position to kind of make Labour Party, well, not Labour Party, just make any party act for nature. He combines scientific authority, emotional clarity, and cross-generational trust, which is very important. I think in his position, the trust is very important. So that's definitely a key takeaway from other activists in his position. You have to build trust and credibility with the public you appeal to. David Attenborough offers a non-confrontational, fact-based communication style, which is highly effective for mainstream audiences. Especially, he appeals to the youth. So using like online methods, like documentaries, the Save Our Wild House campaign, which is mainly on the website, and the UN People See, which was on screen or like on Facebook with like hashtags. That is definitely a big way to appeal. And also the fact, importantly, the fact that he's very credible in his communication and in his position is also really creates a connection. I mean, in his documentaries, I think Javier definitely mentioned it about how his communication style really appeals to the audience, engages the audience, and educates, which is, again, in this particular scenario, very important to educate. So, I mean, the key takeaways, the key lessons for other activists, from my perspective, could be use storytelling, not just data, because, again, we have to engage the audience, you have to convince them, you have to build that trust, that personal connection that then puts them on your side. If there's no personal connection, there's no sympathy, like, nobody picks a side. When there's personal connection, you build links, you build bonds, and that makes you change your behavior, which is important here. Then, again, build trust and emotional resonance, which fits into what I just said, and be visible, but grounded in evidence. Don't be visible as in, like, obviously, like, you know, be powerful, like, engage, but, like, don't overdo it. You have to be grounded in evidence. What you have to say has to be true, because if the second it slips out and you overstate, then your credibility loses, and it's important to maintain that credibility. And David Attenborough proves that leadership can come from narrative power and not necessarily formal power. And he encourages future climate leaders to prioritize education, inclusion, and inspiration. So in the end, I do believe that he is a climate leader. Even if he hasn't been able to implement any policy, he has been able to navigate his position perfectly in mobilizing mass support. And this mass support will eventually change policymaking, for sure.
Well, I completely agree with you, Giulio. Despite not holding any political position, David Attenborough definitely is a climate leader today, in my opinion as well. Great. And I would say that with this, we can end today's episode. Thank you very much again to Giulio and Javier for joining me today. It has been a pleasure to have you here on Rai Affairs. I'll remind to our audience that this has been the third in a series of six episodes as part of the IE RAIA Summer Research Program of 2025. To our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to check out Giulio and Javier's report at raiagroup.org and to follow us on social media to receive updates on new articles and contents. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.